diamond now, only spot a few blacks I have. Diamond now, only spot a few blacks I have.
What is going on, my people? Welcome. I am your host, Robert Stevens, and welcome to the first episode of the Black Work Experience. I started this podcast because I was really tired of being one of the few or the only black males or even a black person at my jobs. These things come with their own challenges. Being perfect, wearing the weight of the black experience on your shoulders, and always having to speak to it. And I began to ask myself and my friends questions like, have you ever been the only black person or one of the few black people at your job and like wondering, what are you doing there? Have you experienced microaggression after microaggression from Karen and her friends and wondering, hey, how am I going to deal with Karen and how am I keep these coins coming? If you say yes to these questions, then guess what? You're in the right place. And we're going to dive deep on these issues. The Black Work Experience explores the intersection between race, class, and privilege in America and in the workforce. Our goal is to tell the stories of those who paved and currently pave the way. On this episode, we're chatting with John King, the first Democratic African-American Secretary of Education under, you guessed it, you know who I'm about to say, President Barack Obama. As people of color gain more institutional, political, and economic power, we often find ourselves surrounded by people who do not look like us, talk like us, or even think like us. And this podcast discusses what it's like to walk in the shoes of those individuals who feel alone. I want to be clear, I recognize that black people are not monolithic, so this experience may not be germane to everyone. But to a lot of us, this can be difficult to navigate, and we want to empower others by sharing the stories of those upon whose shoulders we stand. Now, black work experience is for all people, but let me be clear, this is for black people. We want people of color to know that you're not the only one experiencing microaggressions, otherness, and potential loneliness at work. Those who identify with majority culture, you have an opportunity to hear what your coworkers experience daily, and hopefully you'll be able to develop some strategies to become better allies. Now that I dropped who I am and what this podcast is about, guess what? It's mail time. During mail time, we read what we call the You Tried It. These are emails, DMs, and for those who know me, text messages from people who have tried you at work. This first one comes from a friend of mine in D.C. named Jamal, who was working late in his office and called an Uber to get home. Let's check it out. Hey, Black Work Experience. I wanted to share with you my You Tried It moment. I was working late at my office, busting my butt because I'm the only black man at the org, and I just started not too long ago. So the pressure to represent for my entire race is still fresh and heavy on my shoulders. So I got ready to leave and call the Uber. Mind you, it's after 12 o'clock a.m. and the streets are deserted. I am in a full suit with a briefcase. Did I mention I am in a full suit? Well, when I opened the door to the Uber, the driver looked at me and we made small talk for a few minutes before he asked me what I was doing out so late. I told him, you know, I just had to work late and cover some bases. And he asked me if I was a janitor. No disrespect to janitors. They play a valuable role at every org. On the contrary, I have never seen a janitor clean a building in a full three-piece suit. I asked him point blank, why did I have to be the help? Why couldn't you imagine me being the CEO or the COO of the organization? He stumbled through an apology, and I promptly inserted my headphones and drowned them out. Next time, I hope he can see me as more than the help. Signed, a disgruntled black man. Wow, y'all, this is deep. This is deep. And I know, I mean, if you're like me, I'm sure many of you may have experienced this before. I know I have. Full professional attire, and you were mistaken for something other than what you were. Man, that's crazy. I think here that the assumption, in my opinion, was based predominantly on the person's skin color, on Jamal's color. If you have your own example, or you know what it's feels like to go through what Jamal experienced, hey, share your story with us on our IG page. You can find us on IG at BWEPod. I repeat, BWE Pod, or you can find us on Twitter at BWE Podcast. If you have an email, you want to send us your story via email, you can email us at blackworkexperiencepod@gmail.com. Y'all, I'm telling you, I think about this story that Jamal just shared, and I'm thinking about the story I just heard not too long ago about a young man in Georgia who was running in his neighborhood, and apparently they had had some break-ins in his neighborhood. And so some white males gathered their guns and chased them. Now, the gentleman apparently got out of there. They couldn't catch him, so they ran, got in their truck, cornered him, found him, and ended up shooting and killing him, all because they thought he was a black man who had been robbing people in the neighborhood. Man, listen to me. This thing got to change, whether you're at work or whether you're in the community. Like, mistaking people of color, specifically black people, this is crazy. Jamal, thank you for sharing your story. Once again, you all, if y'all have stories you want to share, get it into us. Now let's dive in and talk a little bit to our guest of honor, John King. Thank you all. We can just jump right into this interview with our amazing guest, John B. King Jr. Hello, everyone.
Hello. Thanks for the opportunity to join you.
Wonderful. Absolutely honored to have you here. I want to tell you all a little bit about John B. King Jr. He's currently the president and CEO of the Education Trust, a national nonprofit organization that seeks to identify and close opportunity and achievement gaps from preschool through college. Before that, John served in President Barack Obama's cabinet as the 10th U.S. Secretary of Education. Unlike a lot of people in leadership positions, John came up through the school system, starting his career as a high school social studies teacher in Puerto Rico and Boston, and later as a middle school principal. Basically, this man knows education and has seen almost everything. Would you agree?
Well, I don't know if I've seen everything, but I've certainly worked at almost every level in education.
Yeah. Indeed. So let's jump right into the questions. I think the first question is, you know, it's our typical one. So who is John B. King? Tell us about yourself, your life journey, and what you're doing these days.
Sure. So I'm originally from New York City, the son of public school teachers. Both my parents spent their whole careers working for New York City public schools. But both my parents passed away when I was a kid. My mom when I was 8, my dad when I was 12. And in the period in between, after my mom passed, I lived with my dad was quite sick with undiagnosed Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. So home through that whole period was scary, unstable, inconsistent. But school was the place that was consistent and structured and nurturing. And you know, I always say to folks, I'm alive today, I'm able to do the work I'm doing because I had amazing New York City public school teachers who made school a place that was compelling. Mm. I had a teacher, Mr. Osterweil, my teacher in 4th, 5th, 6th grade. He had us do Midsummer Night's Dream and Alice in Wonderland productions. Mm-hmm. We read the New York Times every day in his class. We learned the capital and leader of every country in the world. He took us to the museum and the ballet. He just made school a place where I could be a kid when I couldn't be a kid outside of school. And that really changed the trajectory of my life. So, you know, after my dad passed, I moved between family members and schools, but it was always teachers that really were at the center. In high school, I got in a lot of trouble. Like many kids who've experienced trauma, mm-hmm. I was angry about the things that I'd gone through, and I acted out, got in trouble, got kicked out of high school. I was saying, first Secretary of Education, I've been kicked out of high school. But I was blessed that folks gave me a second chance. I had family members, mentors, teachers, who, even though I'd made a lot of mistakes, got kicked out, they still saw potential in me. And thanks to them, I was able to, you know, to get my life back on track. Went on to college, went to Harvard, decided while I was there that I loved working with young people. I got involved in running after school and summer programs. And that's really what led me into education, led me to be a teacher and a principal and lead a network of schools. And then I was commissioner of education in New York, and then came to Washington to work for President Obama. Had the incredible privilege to be first Deputy Secretary of Education and then Secretary. And, you know, I've really had this chance to see education from the classroom level, from the state policy level, from the federal level, and came to EdTrust because the truth is our system isn't doing well enough for low-income students and students of color. We need to do better, and EdTrust is an organization that has as its mission making sure we as a country do better.
your story is so, it resonates with me. And, you know, we didn't discuss this at all, but I lost my father 7 years ago. So I was 25 when I lost my father. And sometimes I question and I ask myself, would I have rather had my father when I was young, or would I rather have had my father as I was older? Mm. You know, I'm married now, I have kids. So mm-hmm. it would be amazing to be able to ask my father, like, how did you do this? Mm-hmm. What decisions did you make? Like, how did you ask my mother to marry you? You know, mm-hmm. those sort of
That's
things.
Right. Yeah.
Do you ever think about that and wonder, like, which one would you rather have had?
Yeah. I mean, I think all the time about just, you know, how much I wish I could ask my parents mm-hmm. about their careers, about their choices. Mm-hmm. You know, I have two girls, they're 12 and 14. You know, I think about what advice would they give
yes.
about parenting. I wish my girls had the chance to get to know mm-hmm. my parents.
Yeah.
It's a loss, a hole that I don't think ever goes away.
Moving forward. Now, you talked about a lot in that short time frame, and you talked about, like, racial identity, mm-hmm. Like your mission at Education Trust. How do you think, like, your racial identity as a person of color, man of color, impacted you both as a student getting kicked out, as well as, like, right now in your professional career?
Yeah. You know, it's one of those things, when you think about racism and how race works in American society.
Yeah.
Sometimes you don't know, right?
Right.
You don't know what role bias and judgments about race played in particular interactions mm-hmm. over your life. But I will say, you know, certainly when I think about being a teenager, part of what I was angry about was my sense that people viewed me in a particular way as a young man of color, had a set of assumptions mm-hmm. about me. I was very frustrated in my high school that the curriculum did not acknowledge mm. the full story of our history. I can remember arguing with some of my teachers about history and literature mm-hmm. and just feeling like they did not see me.
Mm-hmm.
And that the curriculum did not see people of color and communities of color. You know, it wasn't true of every class, but
right.
but you know, I think I know that for me as a teacher and a principal, part of what I wanted was the opportunity to be a positive influence in the lives of young people like me.
Mm-hmm.
And so have really focused my career on communities of color, low-income students of color, urban students of color in particular. You know, I think as a teacher, you know, I had many of the experiences that we've actually written about at Ed Trust, about the ways in which teachers of color pay what I've called an invisible tax,
mm.
where, you know, people would assume, as a man of color in particular, oh, well, you should take care of discipline because,
mm-hmm.
you know, of course that's the role you should play. Or, you know, I'm African American and Puerto Rican, so the assumption that we hear from a lot of Latino teachers, the assumption that, you know, because you're Latino, you're going to be the bridge to Latino parents, you're
mm-hmm.
going to be the translator, you know, so forth. So I certainly had that experience as a teacher and principal of having people's expectations defined by my racial identity. But, you know, ultimately, I think I feel very blessed to have had the opportunity, I hope, to help young people see possibility
mm.
through me and through my experience. You know,
mm-hmm.
one of the things I really like to do is to talk to young people who've been in trouble.
Yes.
Young people in juvenile justice facilities, young people who have gotten in trouble in school, to tell them it can be different
mm-hmm.
and that they don't have to be defined by mistakes that they've made as a teenager, that they can choose a different path and that their life can turn out differently.
Yeah.
'Cause I think kids sometimes can lose faith in themselves.
Mm.
When they've gotten in trouble, So, you know, I feel very blessed to be able to contribute in that way.
I think about what you said, and I think about my own experience. I taught 6th and 7th grade math and science in Charlotte, North Carolina. And I just could not imagine seeing what my kids went through. And I'm from a low-income background. Both of my parents, they kind of grew up in a different time frame. You know, my mother was born in the 50s. My father in 47, so the late 40s. And it was just very different for them in regards to, like, living in rural part of North Carolina, access to education, having to work in cotton fields. And it was just a very different world. And my mother stayed on me. Like, education was so important to her because she knew what she did not receive. And her ultimate goal was to make sure that, like, all of her children received good quality education. But I think back to my time in, like, K through 12, I never once had a male teacher of color. Mm-hmm. Never once. Mm-hmm. And when I went into the classroom, I experienced that tax. Teachers would send their disciplinary problems to my classroom because they felt like I could handle it because I was a man. I mean, I'm a first-year teacher. I have no idea. But that is very real. But I remember back to just being able to build that bond with my kids and explain to them, like, if I can make it coming from where I came from, you could. And there is something powerful. There is immensely powerful in that. And I just want to say thank you because I think a lot of times we talk about, like, President Obama and what he represents to, like, our community and to communities of color. If he can do it, you can do it. Mm-hmm. And I think on a granular level, like, what I saw is if I could come back and teach, if I can make it from the community that I came from, where we don't have rec centers, you know, where I grew up.
There's no rec centers.
There are no gyms, no metro lines that go to museums. Like, they can make it as well. So I think that your story is exceptionally powerful. And when we tell these stories, that's the purpose of, like, our podcast, so that individuals know that people who are doing amazing things exist and they can come back. And if they can do it, you can.
That's right.
So that was the whole purpose of, I saw myself in education being able to do that. So about microaggressions a little bit. You know, we know that microaggressions are real, right? We know that a lot of times they're not immediately apparent. You have to be trained to know and see them. What do you think have been some of the most memorable microaggressions you've experienced in your career?
Yeah. You know, it's so hard to know what the intentions are behind what someone does. Some of the most painful things are things you experience as a kid, right?
Yeah.
So I think back to when I was, I don't know, I must have been in kindergarten, and some of the white kids in my class said that I was dirty because of the color of my skin. And they were sort of teasing me about being dirty, and I remember just feeling horrible and just not knowing even how to make sense of it. And coming home and talking to my mom, and, you know, because my mom passed when I was so young, I have more limited memories,
right?
But one thing I remember very much is coming home, telling her about that, and at the time, I loved Cinnamon Life cereal. Just had Cinnamon Life cereal every day. And my mom told me, "You're not dirty, you're cinnamon." And it was like this huge weight was lifted. Like, cinnamon? Like, Cinnamon Life? Right? And so I think about that because that was a moment where, you know, yes, there were these, there was this racism that I was experiencing, but my mom, through validating me and giving me a positive sense of identity, was able to help me. And I think that's part of what we have to do as educators.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, as I moved into being a principal or a system leader, then the question is, how does the system support teachers of color when they experience those microaggressions, right? When someone assumes, you know, makes the assumption that you're going to be the disciplinarian, or makes the assumption that you don't have as much to say about curriculum and what curriculum should look like, or, you know, when you get passed over for an opportunity, you need the system to send a message that is positive, that you are valued, mm-hmm. so that you can kind of move on from those experiences. And I don't think we do a good enough job of that. You know, and I'm grateful to those mentors who stepped in and supported me mm-hmm. at those moments,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah. I think what you're talking about is your mother was your ally.
Mm-hmm.
She showed up for you in a way that mm-hmm. I think we as people of color, we have an obligation to show up for our kids.
Yeah.
I think that's a lot of pressure to put on teachers.
Yes.
It's a lot of pressure to put on systems. What we're dealing with right now is, you know, you think about all the things that come into play for a kid to be successful in school. I remember teaching a student, and I never forget, he never, ever did homework. I mean, mm-hmm. It's par for the course, but he never did homework. Mm-hmm. And I remember taking him outside the classroom and just asking him, hey, why do you never do your homework? Like, just tell me. Mm-hmm. And he looked me in my eyes, I never forget, had big brown eyes. And he said, Mr. Stevens, I'm homeless. If my mother does not park near a street light, mm-hmm. I can't see. We live in our car.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes me think about my next question. What can we do? Like, what other systems or services are in place, or should we have in place, to teach the whole kid? Because
that's right.
we deal
that's
with,
right.
you know, we deal with, like, let's teach this kid ABCs. But what I learned very early in my career as a teacher is I can't teach a kid who's hungry.
Mm-hmm.
So I made sure to keep a food pantry in my classroom.
Yes, yes, right? That's right.
I had another kid who, I mean, he just wouldn't wash.
Mm-hmm.
His parents would not make him wash, so he would come to school and he would get teased.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we had a conversation, and what I ended up doing, I was a football coach. So I had access to the locker rooms, and I asked his mother, I said, hey, do you mind if, like, he washes? And his mother said no. And I got permission from my principal, so I would come to school early, and he would take a shower in the mm-hmm. in the mm-hmm. football showers. Mm-hmm. You can't teach a kid who smells bad. You know, like, there are so many things outside of school that teachers have to deal with, specifically when you're dealing with kids of color due to, like, systemic factors. But what do you think we should do to address those things to make sure that we can teach a kid, that we can give them what they need to be successful?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think we need to think about it on two levels. There's what we can do in schools, and mm-hmm. there's what we have to do as a society,
yes.
right? So in schools, I think it is access to those other supports that we can provide. Mm-hmm. So whether it's having the free breakfast and free lunch program and making it so there's no stigma mm-hmm. associated with having meals at school, mm-hmm. right? It's schools that have health clinics in the school so that kids can get access to healthcare. You know, I think about this study that was done in Baltimore by Johns Hopkins about vision care. And basically, you know, the finding of this study was really not surprising. Kids who can't read the book or see the board don't do as well. If you get them vision care and they can read the book and see the board, they do better, right?
Right.
Like, it's not rocket science.
Right, right.
But we don't do it. Mm-hmm. Systematically, we don't make sure that kids have access to vision care, dental care, health care mm-hmm. in schools. We could,
right.
right? There are places that have community school models that are doing that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether a school is open and available for after school programming, a place where you can do your homework after school if you
exactly.
can't do it outside of school, and where there are support staff there to support you with your homework, right? So there's things that schools can do to put in place wraparound services. But to me, part of what your question calls for is for us to ask as a society, mm. are we doing the right things by our children? You know, we are a rich country.
We are.
With extraordinary resources. Folks shouldn't be living in the car. Mm. right? Like we don't have, that doesn't have to be true.
You're right.
Folks shouldn't be struggling to get access to healthcare, to get access to food, mm-hmm. right? Like we have such abundance. We ought to be able to figure out as a society how to make sure that we support our young people so that they have a chance to thrive. It is in all of our interests. A kid who is hungry and homeless and therefore can't make progress academically is a kid who's not going to be prepared as a citizen, not going to be prepared to be successful in the workforce, right? That's bad for society. Mm-hmm. So we ought to put in place systems of support. I often wonder, you know, how would our public policy look different if we began with the question, what does every child need to be prepared to thrive? Mm-hmm. And then how do we organize ourselves as a society mm-hmm. to provide that? Unfortunately, in the current political moment, that is not the way folks are thinking about how we organize ourselves, but yeah. we should be.
Makes me think about Dr. Rutter. I left the classroom because I felt like people who were making decisions for my students and I never stepped foot in the classroom themselves. Mm-hmm. This is back in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. I felt like just like the laws that were being passed in my state really constricted my ability to teach my kids. Mm-hmm. And that bothered me. So I left the classroom and I moved up here to D.C. to pursue a Master of Public Policy degree. Mm-hmm. And I never forget Dr. Rutter in my program would always ask, what type of society do we want to live mm-hmm. in? Mm-hmm. And she would challenge us to design policy that answered that question.
That's right.
And she's probably one of the best professors I've ever had. But your statement made me think about LeBron James. Mm, I know everyone's talking
yeah.
about I Promise. Yeah. And this school, you know, he offers free uniforms, mm-hmm. free breakfast, lunch, snacks, food pantry for families in mm-hmm. the school, and for those who graduate, guaranteed tuition to University of Akron. Basically, a lot of wraparound services, both for the students as well as GED programs for parents.
That's right.
So what are your thoughts on this, like celebrities opening schools and like this particular school, which has all of these wraparound
yeah,
services.
Yeah. Well, I'm you know, inspired and impressed by LeBron James doing that. There are plenty of celebrities who are not giving back in that way, so it's inspiring to see him give back in that way. And I'm thrilled that he's been so intentional and thoughtful about it. Mm-hmm. I think the next question is, what do we do to make those opportunities available systemically, mm. right? And I think for a lot of folks who are involved in philanthropy, mm-hmm. they're often giving to individual projects, but I also think there's this broader question of how do you impact the system, mm-hmm. right? If you grow up in Ohio, you ought to be able, in my view, you ought to be able to go get post-secondary education in an affordable way. We ought to make, from my standpoint, public higher education tuition free, mm-hmm. and we ought to provide the supports that low-income students need to succeed while they're there, whether that's help with books, help with housing, help with food, so forth. Mm-hmm. We could do that as a society.
We could.
But we choose not to, right? And so, you know, the question for me, yes, we should all be cheering for what LeBron James is doing, and we should all be asking, how do we make sure that all kids are getting those kinds of opportunities and supports, mm-hmm. right? It's great to have the, you know, programs in place for parents at that school, mm-hmm. but shouldn't we have programs in place for parents at all schools,
yes.
right? Wouldn't we be a better society if parents could get GED classes, job training, language classes at their kids' school, if we were thinking about schools as sort of multi-generational institutions? Mm-hmm. So again, I love what LeBron is doing, and I think, you know, the way I challenge all of us is how do we all step up to make sure those things are systemically available?
You brought it to the systemic level, and I think about you and your role, excuse me, at the Department of Education. Like, you were tasked with looking at it from a systems level.
Mm-hmm.
As you like reflect upon your time spent there, what do you think was your greatest impact regarding, like, we're going to leave this specifically towards kids of color, and low-income kids. What do you think your impact from a system-wide level, like how did you impact them?
Yeah. Well, you know, in some ways the jury is out, and because probably the most one of the most consequential things that we worked on when I was there at the department was the Every Student Succeeds Act, mm-hmm. you know, the new federal education law that President Obama signed in December of 2015, which puts a lot of responsibility in the hands of states, mm-hmm. but charges states with a real civil rights responsibility to ensure equitable educational opportunity, right? Because it was a reauthorization of the original Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965, mm-hmm. as you know, which was a civil rights law.
Yes.
Right? And so ESSA, the Every Student Succeeds Act, was intended to say to states, hey, here's a lot of flexibility about how you design your accountability system, how you intervene in schools that are struggling, mm-hmm. but your job is to make sure that schools serve low-income students, students of color, students with disabilities, English learners well, mm-hmm. and create opportunity for them. So in many ways, the jury is out on that. States have submitted plans. The department has reviewed those plans. In my view, the department has not done a good enough job mm-hmm. Under the current administration pushing states to demonstrate that they are committed to the civil rights obligations mm-hmm. of the law. But we are working at the Ed Trust with civil rights advocates, business leaders, community-based organizations, folks like NCLD, right, to put pressure on states, governors, legislatures, state boards of education, district leaders to do what the law requires, to mm-hmm. actually use the law to advance education equity.
Yeah.
So, as I say, the jury's still out.
Jury's still out, yeah.
You know, that said, there were individual initiatives that I'm so proud of that made an immediate difference in people's lives. Mm. I think about a project we had around Pell Grants for folks who are incarcerated.
Mm.
You know, in the mid-90s, Congress made a terrible decision and took away access to Pell Grants for folks who are incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
Many programs around the country that were providing higher education in prisons closed
yep.
because of that. The reality is folks who get educational programming while incarcerated are significantly less likely to return to prison, right?
Yeah.
So a 43% reduction in recidivism, participating in any educational mm-hmm. program. Many programs where students graduate with a college degree while incarcerated, you're talking about 98% of folks not returning,
mm-hmm.
right? That's powerful. But that was taken away in the mid-90s. We had a project to create a pilot program,
mm-hmm.
69 colleges and universities around the country working with prisons to offer programs, higher education programs to folks who are incarcerated. Those programs are creating opportunity for thousands of students around the country. Now the task is we got to persuade Congress to make Pell Grants available to all folks who are incarcerated to correct the mistake of the mid-90s.
Mm-hmm.
But that is a program that changed life trajectories for individual people who are participating. So I'm very proud of those things.
Absolutely.
But again, ESSA is the biggest thing that we worked on, and the jury is still out.
Yeah, no, I think that is spot on. I know we've spent a lot of time reading every state plan
mm-hmm.
And grading them.
Mm-hmm.
How are they meeting this mandate? And I think what a lot of people don't realize about the Department of Ed is that it's first and foremost a civil rights agency.
Mm-hmm.
Like that, it is a civil rights agency. So I guess my next question follows that further. How do you see this current administration failing in meeting this mandate? I know you mentioned it a little bit,
but what
other areas do you think?
Well, look, I mean, I'm deeply, deeply worried about what this administration has done so
yes.
far. I mean, you see it with ESSA, mm-hmm. that they have not really held states to the standards that the law requires. You see it in their approach to civil rights enforcement. They are dismantling the Office for Civil Rights. They've, in fact, directed people in the Office for Civil Rights not to look for systemic violations of civil rights when a complaint is filed, mm-hmm. to only treat it as an isolated complaint. You see it in their approach to higher ed, where they are removing all the steps that we took to try to ensure that colleges deliver quality to their students. So they are really trying to throw open the doors to these predatory for-profit colleges that take advantage of students, particularly low-income students and students of color, by promising the moon but delivering terrible quality, not graduating students, leaving students with debt and no degree. You see it in how they've approached sexual assault on campus, where they have essentially backed away from enforcing Title IX protections on campuses for students. You see it in their approach to affirmative action, where they are essentially trying to send a message to colleges and universities to stop considering race in college admissions, which is deeply problematic. African-American Latino students are already underrepresented at elite universities, research universities, state flagship universities, and the administration is trying to make that worse. So you see it sort of across the board. The list is long. You see it with LGBTQ students, where the administration is abandoning many of the efforts we made to try to protect those students from bullying and discrimination.
Significant disproportionality.
Exactly. You see them walking away from really just asking. I mean, what we were trying to do there was really just say to folks, if you have students of color overrepresented, if you have, as in being identified as students with disabilities, if you have students of color who are being significantly overrepresented in the population of students who are pulled out of class and put in separate environments, then you ought to ask the question, why is that? What's behind that? That was essentially the purpose of the rule, just to say, if you have overrepresentation of students of color, ask the question of what's going on behind that. They backed away from that. So, I mean, you just see it on issue after issue.
You do, you do. And I mean, I think the good thing is a lot of people are aware now. I think that there's good and bad. The bad thing is, like, students who need the protections the most are being failed at the highest rate. The good thing is, I think a lot of people are aware, and there's a movement taking place. Even within the education, like the education space, people are saying, like, enough is enough. I'm consistently in meetings where people are talking about it, and, like, we know that this agenda that our current Secretary of Education has is deeply harmful to low-income kids, students of color, like you said, students with disabilities, you know, LGBTQ, the entire gamut. And what we see is a lot of people jumping in and saying, you know what, like, let's do something about it. One thing that I don't hear enough of is, like, equality of opportunity. So when we talk about, like, equity, and when we talk about school choice, what are your thoughts on how you balance school choice and equity, especially in communities of color? Like, because a lot of people who may be supportive of school choice, have access to it in ways that people from low-income communities do not. I spend time in both rural as well as urban areas. And you think about a lot of times where schools pop up in terms of school choice, and it is in low-income areas, but they don't have the resources. So parents, they need good schools. But how do we balance school choice and equity? Is there a balance? What are your thoughts?
Well, one is we should build a system where every school is chosen, right? Where every school gets the resources and supports and quality teachers and quality opportunities, right? Because that's what we should aspire to for all kids. Now, that said, school choice means lots of different things in different places. So I live in Montgomery County in Maryland. For Montgomery County, school choice means within a system of traditional district schools, some schools will have a STEM focus, some schools will have a communication arts focus, some schools will have a humanities focus. Some schools will have an international baccalaureate program. And some schools will be dual language. And you can choose based on what is an interest that a family or a student has. That's one level of school choice mm-hmm. within a system that strives to make all of those schools good. Mm-hmm. That's school choice I support. Another version of school choice that you see in some places, like a Massachusetts, mm-hmm. charter schools where there is a very high bar to get a charter. The charter schools are public schools. Mm-hmm. They are accountable to the state. Mm-hmm. There's very rigorous oversight of the academics and the operations of those schools. Kids get in by lottery. The schools have to deliver good outcomes for kids, or the schools are closed, mm-hmm. right? The state is very clear about meaningful accountability. Public schools, public dollars, publicly accountable in the charter sector, that is a kind of school choice that I can support.
You support that as well.
In contrast, you have a state like Michigan, mm-hmm. terrible charter law, low bar, lots of terrible for-profit, mm-hmm. predatory schools, an authorizer system where the charter authorizers are essentially incentivized to keep bad schools open mm-hmm. and to open more of them because they get a cut of the revenue. That is school choice that I oppose.
Yes.
We do not need that. That is bad for kids, and we see the consequences. We also see other states now go into these voucher systems mm-hmm. where you're taking public dollars away from public schools mm-hmm. and putting them into private schools, often with very little oversight. That strikes me as wrong. Now, look, if someone wants to send their child to a private school and to pay for it, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. But to take money from
the public schools
yes. to send it to private schools, that I'm opposed to. And there are lots of ways, that's described, sometimes called vouchers, sometimes called tax credits. But the bottom line is, if what you're doing is taking public money away from public schools to give to private schools, that to me is problematic. I'm against that. So the challenge for folks who believe in those good examples of school choice mm-hmm. is they are now lumped in with school choice that is quite problematic. Mm-hmm. And so I always try to parse through what do we mean by mm-hmm. school choice, and what does it look like when it's done well?
Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense. And this is a very hot button issue in communities of color. Who should have access to school choice? Mm-hmm. What does school choice look like? And I think you parsing through that will benefit a lot of people, because the three different varieties are often conflated
yes.
in a way that, yes. that makes it difficult to get to the nuance surrounding
the issue.
That's right. Moving slightly in a different direction, as we talk about like colleges, and what happens when we have these kids who go to these for-profit schools, and what we see is that a lot of colleges that are educating like students from marginalized communities, we see them making it to college, but we don't see them making it through college.
That's right. That's right.
What do you think we could do? What do you think we should do, and we being like a society as well as maybe the Department of Education, to help kids, specifically kids from these marginalized communities, kids of color, low-income students, to make it through college? Like, how do we set them up, whether that's on a K-12 level, or what can we do on a collegiate level to make sure they're successful, they're getting through college, not just to college?
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's a bunch of things we need to do. One is these predatory for-profit colleges that are really just scams.
Right.
We have to shut those down. And, unfortunately, the current administration wants to grow that sector, mm-hmm. Wants more of those schools, wants to look the other way when those schools are taking advantage of kids. Now, there are some proprietary schools, for-profit schools, some small ones that are doing good things in particular places. So it's not about the designation, mm-hmm. but it is about the behavior. Mm-hmm. And if you have these for-profit schools that are taking advantage of people, they should be shut down. Mm-hmm. And the current administration is walking away from that. So that's one thing we need to do. Two, we know lots of students start and don't finish. Mm-hmm. There are a number of factors in that. One is for sure academic preparation. Are we doing a good enough job in K-12 making sure that when students get to college, they are ready to do college-level work? Two if they're not ready to do college level work, do we have smart strategies about how to help them? Mm. And we can see a real difference between colleges that put students in remedial courses that are sort of dead end courses, where they are, you know, spending their Pell dollars, their savings on courses that aren't getting them any closer to graduation, versus other colleges that put in place co-requisite classes, mm-hmm. where you're getting the support you need to close those gaps, but you're also making progress towards actually getting credits, mm-hmm. right? So there are smarter ways to deal mm-hmm. with the gaps in preparation. There are financial challenges. You know, Pell grants are at like a 40-year low in the amount of college costs that they cover. There are some institutions that are putting in place emergency grants for students who are experiencing financial difficulty mm-hmm. that are increasing aid for low-income students so that they're not just looking at tuition, but books and mm-hmm. housing and all the other costs that come with school. So that's another thing we can do to help students finish. We know there are many students on college campuses experiencing food insecurity, housing right. insecurity. Campuses can do something about that by having food pantries, mm-hmm. by making meal plans available that are affordable and healthy, helping students with access to affordable housing, right? And then there are institutional practices and behaviors. So I think about a place like Georgia State. Mm-hmm. Georgia State has essentially closed the racial gaps in college attainment through really smart advising systems where, you know, if you sign up for a class that isn't going to help you get to graduation in your major, an advisor calls you and says, hey, I saw your schedule for this semester. You sure you want to take this class? Let's talk about it. If you get a bad grade on a midterm, advisor calls you. They call it, you know, intrusive advising. I sometimes jokingly call it nagging, yeah. right? It's what you and I are going to do for our kids, right? Yes. But, you know, somebody calls and says, hey, you got a bad midterm grade. What are you doing about it? You going to office hours? Have you talked to the professor? Mm-hmm. Do you know where the writing center is? Have you gone, right? So smart advising can be the difference. So there's policy work that we need to do around affordability and institutional supports. But then there's the behavior of individual institutions. We did a study looking at colleges at the address, colleges and how well African-American students do. Mm. We found you can look at two colleges, same demographics, right? Same racial makeup, same income level makeup, same entering SAT score. Mm-hmm. Huge differences in their graduation rates for African-American students, mm. 20, 30, 40 point differences. And we start to look at why. Give you an example. UC Riverside. UC Riverside has a much higher graduation rate than similar institutions for African-American students. One of the things they did was take seriously that they needed to create a sense of belonging on mm. campus. Recruiting diverse faculty made a difference in whether or not students felt welcome, supported, could see themselves mm-hmm. in the faculty. So, you know, there are things we can do. We don't have to have the completion crisis that we do. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, at the federal level, we're headed in the wrong direction.
I agree.
We need states to do things differently. We need institutions to do things differently.
We need states to fund education.
Yes.
What we've seen, in my opinion, is a concerted effort across the country to cut education funding to make up for, you know.
That's right.
Areas where they need more money or they believe. One thing that you talked about seeing yourself in your professors. I want to ask you a personal question about, like, you. Did you ever experience that sense of otherness in your collegiate career? You know, you attended some pretty elite schools. And
yeah.
I know one thing that we talk about, I had the privilege of attending HBCU and for undergrad. And there's a very big difference in how I interacted with my college, the affinity I have for
sure.
my university in undergrad, which is an HBCU, versus my graduate degrees, which are at PWIs.
Mm-hmm.
I had one professor of color in my graduate degree program, one. And, you know, undergrad at HBCU, I found myself.
Mm-hmm.
My professor taught me about the civil rights movement, and he started a Black Panther chapter. You know, in Winston-Salem. So I think about that, Dr. Little. I think about the fact that, you know, I was blessed to be student body president. I brought Bobby Seale to my university to speak as NCA president, right? My professors didn't teach me things that they learned in a book. They taught me things that they lived in real life. And, you know, a lot of times I didn't read in high school. I didn't read the autobiography of Malcolm X. But that's probably like the most impactful book that I've ever read. And I learned about that at my HBCU. So whereas a lot of my friends who did not attend the HBCU, we would have conversations about, I don't know if I can make it here. I don't know if this makes sense while they were at PWIs. I didn't experience that. Did you experience any of that sense of otherness? Like maybe you didn't belong because, as I stated at the beginning, every job I've had, for the most part, I've been the only African-American male. So much so that I've come to expect that. And so I wear a mask. We're being very real on this podcast. There are two different sides of me. There are the sides that, you know, I get at job at my place of employment where, you know, I present this way, and then I go home and I take off the mask. And I am myself. So how did you experience that, you know, in collegiate experience? And then how do you experience it now?
You know, certainly when I was in college, I did have that sense of otherness and that sort of fear, like maybe this isn't the place where I'm supposed to be. And I had this worry that, you know, someone's going to tap me on the shoulder and say, we made a mistake. You know, you're not really supposed to be here. Part of how I dealt with that was that I spent a lot of time in the community doing direct work with young people, after-school programs, summer programs, teaching civics in schools, just doing stuff where I was in Boston rather than on campus. I probably spent as much time doing things in Boston and felt very connected to that community and ultimately ended up living in the same neighborhood where I'd volunteered as a college student and teaching in that same neighborhood. You know, I think I can think of one experience where I was in a class. You know, when you talk about being the only one, I was in a class, seminar class. It was a small class with a professor, and I was the only African American male in the class. And a photographer came in to take a picture of the class for the catalog. And I was sitting sort of at the opposite end of the table from the professor. And the photographer came in and, you know, sort of did what photographers do, you know, kind of looked at the landscape of the room and literally went over to the student who was sitting next to the professor, a white student, asked her to move and had me switch so I would be sitting next to the professor because he wanted the right, you know, tableau for the picture. You know, I think that was a moment where I just thought about, is the institutional commitment reflective of what this photographer is hoping for in the picture? And at the time, I would say it wasn't reflective. You know, at Harvard, my class of African-American men was the, I think, smallest number of African-American men that have been admitted in a class in something like 20 years. And so the institution wasn't doing enough, in my view. Certainly wasn't doing enough to make sure that students right down the street in Cambridge or in Boston had access to opportunities at Harvard. Now, I think improvement has been made, you know, over the last 20 years, but there's a lot more that Harvard could do as an institution. There's a lot more that many PWIs could do in terms of making their campuses places that are both welcoming for students of color, but also representative of who we are as a country. You know, again, African-American, Latino students, low-income students are so underrepresented on elite campuses, research university campuses, and that harms all of us. We will be a better country if those campuses reflect our diversity.
I agree. One of my last questions, I want to be respectful of your time, is what would you tell What would you tell that young woman, you know, young professional man who's listening to this podcast and, you know, they're going into work every day, mm-hmm. dealing with these microaggressions, mm-hmm. Dealing with the fact that no one in the office looks like them, and when they have conversations, to be able to chime in, they have to Google what their coworkers are talking about. What is your opinion? I mean, advice to them, like, what would you say to them to keep pushing? You know?
Yeah. A few things. One is maybe it's because I taught high school social studies, right? I think a lot about history, and I would say that the story of America is a story of progress towards delivering on a promise yet unfulfilled, right? So if you think about what America's supposed to be, the promise of life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, the promise of all men are created equal, right? Mm-hmm. We weren't living up to that at the time those words were written, right? When the Declaration of Independence was written, we weren't living up to those words. But if you look over the sweep of our history, you think about the abolitionist movement, you think about the Reconstruction Amendments, adding the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments to the Constitution. You think about the women's suffrage movement. You think about the civil rights movement. You think about the movement we've seen over the last few decades around equal rights for LGBTQ folks. The narrative of America is that, yes, we have not fulfilled the promise, but we are getting ever closer. And so one thing is we have to be mindful of that, and in these times in particular, I think it can be easy to lose sight of that, and folks can feel defeated by the kind of discord we see all around us, mm-hmm. And the negativity. But what we have to remember is there is this progress. Sometimes we slip back, but ultimately it is a narrative about progress, and we each carry that with us, and we stand on the shoulders mm-hmm. of the folks who led that progress, right? We stand on the shoulders of, W.E.B. Du Bois. We stand on the shoulders of Rosa Parks, right? So mm-hmm. we have to remember that. Two, we also have to remember that we as people of color do not carry all the responsibility for making places healthy, diverse communities. The institution, that's the job of the institution, mm. right? So I can think about it as a teacher having the experience, where somebody comes to you and says, oh, it's Black History Month. What are we doing, John? Right?
That's me snap.
Right?
Yes.
That's wrong. Mm. Right, Black History Month isn't my thing. It's our thing because we as a community want to celebrate the history and culture and experiences of all of our community members, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think people carry with them this heavy burden of feeling like as a person of color in a largely white or entirely white setting, I'm going to be the one to make diversity work. No, the institution has that responsibility. And so we've got to find allies and put pressure on the institutions to be responsive. The last thing I'd say is community matters so much. And, I think about the work of a group called the Fellowship in Philadelphia, which is an organization of African-American male teachers. We talked about teacher diversity. Majority of kids in the nation's public schools are kids of color. Only 18% of our teachers are teachers of color. Only 2% of our teachers are African-American men. It can feel lonely. And what the Fellowship does is bring together a community of African-American male educators to fellowship, to mentor young people into the profession, mm-hmm. to support each other. So part of how we navigate is, I think, to find those communities that are affirming, supportive communities of colleagues. And so those affinity groups matter,
yes.
and they make a difference, and they can help feed your soul in a way that allows you to thrive in a variety of environments.
I think that last one, affinity groups, just resonates with me. Luckily, I had the honor and the privilege of teaching with five other African-American male teachers. And every day after school, we would find each other. And we would be able to express, like, this is what happened. And those men, I still talk to them. I left the classroom almost 10 years ago now. But I still talk to them all the time. We still, all of us are still working in education. So, like, you need that. You need that. My very, very last question is, what was your best day on the job? What was the best day that you ever had on the job?
Wow.
It's a good one, right?
Wow. As an educator?
As an educator. Let's do three. As an educator, as a secretary of education, and I guess now in your current role as CEO.
Wow. Wow. That's a hard question. You know, I started a middle school when I was a principal. The graduation for that first set of eighth graders, it was just such a powerful experience. You know, the thing about middle school is, you know, kids change so much. Sixth graders are kind of little kids,
babies.
And then eighth graders are sort of entering young adulthood. They're just so there's just so much change. And so seeing that first class and being with that first class, you know, my first graduating class of eighth graders as a principal, was just, and being with those parents, it just was a wonderful, wonderful experience. Gosh, as secretary, there were so many moments. You know, I think a lot about the moment when we had the celebration of the National Teacher of the Year, Johanna Hayes, who's this amazing teacher from Connecticut, African-American woman. Celebrating her as an African-American woman, National Teacher of the Year, as the first African-American and Puerto Rican Secretary of Education, standing next to President Obama, the three of us together in that moment celebrating teaching and the difference that teachers made in each of our lives that led us to be standing there together at that moment. That was an amazing moment. But it was one of many, you know, standing with the president when he signed the Every Student Succeeds Act. And talked about that law as an extension of the original Elementary and Secondary Education Act, and talked about Lyndon Johnson and the civil rights commitment of the law. That was a powerful, powerful moment. You know, and then in my current role, you know, look, let's be honest, you know, the last year and a half has been hard for people who care about education equity. I know you feel as I do. I mean,
yes.
There's been a lot of hard moments where you feel inspired and hopeful is when we make progress, and that is often at the local level or at the state level. So when we see states adopting a law that is going to get rid of the suspension of pre-K students, which we know disproportionately affects low-income students, students of color, students with disabilities. When you see a state commit to investing in public higher education so that all students will have access to those opportunities. Those moments when we see wins in states that advance education equity, those are the best moments. It's hard to name one, but those are the moments that are most satisfying. Because at the end of the day, the measure of our work isn't just what we talked about, what we said we wanted to do. It's whether we've changed the conditions on the ground for young people who are most vulnerable.
Well, with that being said, we want to thank you. I want to personally thank you for coming by our podcast, Row 1851, and inspiring me. And I know the people who are listening will be inspired as well. thank you for your service and just the work you continue to do. You truly are someone who I can look up to as an educator myself and see your trajectory as someone I would love to pattern my life around. So thank you so much.
Oh, well, thanks for the opportunity to do the podcast. Thanks for doing the podcast, for putting this positive message out into the world. Thanks for the example you are as a educator, as an African-American male educator, and as someone who has taken the lessons you learned in the classroom as a student and as a teacher and turn them into influencing policy in ways that will make it better for kids.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thanks for listening to the Black Workers Experience podcast. If you like the show, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review. If you want to hear more from me, follow me on IG at BWEPod or Twitter at BWEPodcast. Thanks, you all.
Domino, only spot a few blacks ahead. Domino, only spot a few blacks ahead.